You're listening to WEFT Champaign. This has been Women Making Waves, and coming up next is a show called The Rift, a show about climate change and the power dynamics thereof. So stay tuned.
By Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, March 16th, and this is Episode 9 of The Rift. I've spent a lot of time on this show talking about energy, utilities, and the fight for public power. In episode 7, you heard from Liz Jacob, an attorney and organizer in Detroit, Michigan, who is fighting for utility affordability for low-income Detroiters and helping build a vision of democratized, community-owned power. And back in episode 4, I talked to Alex Patterson with Public Power in New York, about the fight to pass the Build Public Renewables Act, and what's next for public power advocates in New York State. And as always, if you'd like to go back and listen to those episodes or any other episode of the show, just search for The Rift on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast aggregator of your choosing. But if this is your first time tuning in, and you need a super quick crash course, the gist of it is this. Most people in the United States are served by for-profit, investor-owned utilities. Broadly speaking, those utilities are doing a pretty terrible job of balancing delivering renewable energy that's reliable, affordable for everyone, and turning a profit while delivering returns to their investors. And realistically, when push comes to shove, it's those investors that tend to take precedence. That's why activists and community members like Liz and Alex are fighting for a different model. Publicly owned, democratically run utility systems that are beholden to the public interest rather than the profit motive. There's an argument to be made, and I think it's a compelling one, that marketizing an essential service like electricity is harmful both for people who can't afford to keep the lights on and for a transition to renewable energy, since choices in energy generation are broadly subject to the whims of the market rather than long-term planning in the public interest. However, when we look at actually existing public power systems, the story begins to get a little more complicated. Consider the example of Eskom, the state-owned electric utility of the nation of South Africa. In recent years, Eskom has made headlines for all the wrong reasons: persistent power outages, increasing rates for consumers, and financial insolvency among them. And now, it's under threat of privatization by the South African government. But would turning Eskom into something akin to our privatized American utilities really solve anything? Or can we imagine a better public power utility? To find out, I spoke with Brian Kamunzi, a South Africa-based researcher with the organization Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about Eskom's current struggles, the threat of privatization, how we got to this point, and what the fight for a better public utility might look like. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Martinelli's Market in downtown Champaign. Whether you're looking for breakfast, lunch, dinner, or catering, you can't go wrong with locally sourced, freshly prepared meals at Martinelli's. Open 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. on Sunday. Martinelli's Market in downtown Champaign. This hour of programming on WEFT is also brought to you by the Champaign Park District. Looking for something fun to do this weekend? The Champaign Park District's Weekend Explorer email comes out every Thursday, jam-packed with ideas, events, and programs for each upcoming weekend. Information on subscribing to the Weekend Explorer can be found at champaignparks.org. And now, here's my conversation with Brian Kamunzi. I'm joined now by Brian Kamunzi, researcher with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks, Roshan. Really excited to be here and looking forward to engaging.
So just to get started, over the past several years, there's been kind of some chaos in South Africa surrounding Eskom, which is the state's publicly owned electric utility. There's been increases in electric rates for customers, while there's been a lot of blackouts around the country. And Eskom itself has struggled to pay down its debts during that time. That seems to have opened the door for the government, led by President Cyril Ramaphosa of the African National Congress, to consider privatization. Could you give an overview of what's been going on?
Yeah, so I think to take a step back, you know, I think the international headlines were made, especially in 2023, when South Africa had a second consecutive record year of load shedding. I think in 2023, it was over 2,000 hours of load sheddings, rotational blackouts that are basically meant to prevent the entire grid from collapsing, but are the consequence of a shortage of generation supply to meet the overall demand. So the idea is that you rotate out power cuts throughout the grid network to ration energy. The question about how we got there is multifaceted, but in short, there are two physical elements. On the one side, the investment in new generation capacity slowed, and we were not able to build new projects in line with our integrated resource plan. It is a state-owned utility. There is a national energy plan which guides procurement of particular energy sources, some by private, some by public ownership means. But essentially, we weren't able to match the mix rates annually that are prescribed in the IRP. And the other side of it is that because of the state-owned utility's financial situation, it was not able to conduct the maintenance required on its public generation fleet and also in some of its grid network infrastructure, which is partly also owned by municipalities. That's another separate issue, which had led to poor outcomes. The public infrastructure was performing poorly. Most of the generation plants are coal-based, and some of them are very old. They are still performing poorly compared to their international counterparts for their age. You know, some of them are about four decades old, but they are still performing particularly poorly. And that's a result of poor maintenance and also a downstream consequence of the financial constraints of the utility. How did we get here? That's a long story. I'm hoping that we get through that over the course of the interview. But in essence, I think ESCOM's move towards a hybrid model, so the World Bank introduced different models of private liberalization in the electricity sector, and one of those that has proliferated in the Global South is the hybrid model. There are very few countries, if any, which have been able to fully privatize and fully liberalize the electricity sector in the Global South. And the hybrid model essentially allows some elements of the sector to remain in public hands and essentially acting as de-risking elements to allow private capital to participate in potentially profitable sectors like generation, leaving elements like the grid infrastructure, distribution, transmission into public hands. So South Africa is quite advanced along the path to that process, but the fight around getting to that process is, I think, is tied up into how ESCOM got into this mess. The electricity price in South Africa is regulated by an independent regulator, which essentially throttles the increases. So ESCOM applies for increases based on its current asset, its valuation of its current asset base, its projections for how much it will sell, and then a range of other factors, including the fact that it now, you know, after some small electricity reforms that allowed private generators to participate after 1998, but really in the early 2000s, starts slowly seeing more private generators participating in the electricity sector in South Africa. You know, ESCOM is now also having to procure power from private producers, diesel, renewable energy, and soon to be a growing list of types of generators. It also needs to purchase fuel because coal is a fuel input into thermal generators, and there were issues around you have inflated coal prices, you have rising demand. This was in the, you know, between 2008 and maybe 2014. Rising electricity demand, I think some of the highest levels in the African continent. And you have a deteriorating public generation fleet. So while that public generation, which is mostly coal, is deteriorating, you start burning more diesel. Diesel is more expensive to operate. And diesel generators that were installed were meant to operate at peak periods, mostly peaking in the evening. So when they started using more diesel to supply during other parts of the day to meet shortfalls and trips that were taking place in the coal fleet, that worsened the financial situation of state-owned utility. Another factor is that, again, because the electricity price is regulated, and at the same time, the state is being courted by neoliberal policymakers that are moving towards the market model, the utility is getting lower revenues than what it needs to maintain its assets. But there isn't a complementary support from the tax base or from the treasury base, from the national treasury, to meet that shortfall. So typically in a regulated electricity sector, you use two revenue streams to ensure that the utility is adequately resourced. You use a blend between your tax policy and your tariff policy. But the neoliberal policymakers essentially argue that you should move to an electricity price that is more reflective of what it costs to provide electricity to each individual user. So you take the tax element progressively, you move away from the tax element. But of course, in the public goods model that South Africa, I think, was initially attempting to employ to some extent, and also where ESCOM was running as a not-for-profit business in a certain way, its model was not to focus on profit maximization, but to build infrastructure for developing industry and also for general purposes of electrification. Now, once you start reducing or freezing the amount that is gotten from the national appropriations, from treasury, from tax, and rely on tariffs, a tariff which is regulated below the level that is needed, you start having a lower than is needed revenue. The other part of it is that most of the distribution of electricity is operated by municipalities in South Africa. Now, municipalities in South Africa cater to, and especially if you're talking about post-apartheid South Africa, there are many regions of the country that are service very low-income households. And we have a constitution that essentially prescribes the right to basic access to electricity, water, and other services. There are many ways to interpret that. But in essence, I'm of the view that our constitution affirms the status of electricity as a public good. And you can see that in some of the crisis, the financial crisis of Eskom, which is that a lot of underfunded municipalities that serve low-income residents, are essentially, they purchase electricity from Eskom and resell it on to residents. But they have not been paying their bills to Eskom, essentially. And there's a complex layer of reasons to that. Corruption is one element. Another element is that the funding model for these municipalities relied on basically charging a small profit on electricity, water, and waste collection in order to fund other services that a municipality is supposed to provide. Now, in a country so unequal, where municipalities have to, and with a constitution that's so ambitious, municipalities have a pretty important role in basic service provision. But they're at odds with the fact that, with the system that has essentially required them to profit make off basic services in order to provide. And now that you might have better outcomes in an area that has a more mixed income profile or more wealthy residents. But in areas that are largely low income, you've got a very low prospect of being able to pay that money, especially when it's understood that people should have access to power whether or not they can pay. So you have several drivers of debt there for Eskom. You have inflating fuel prices from the coal. You have inflated electricity prices that are also being impacted by using diesel because poor public infrastructure performance has been a characteristic. You have municipalities who are not paying, and then you have an electricity price which is regulated below the cost to provide electricity, but you don't have a policy on the back end of it that's ensuring that an appropriate amount of tax revenue meets that shortfall on an annual basis. So that's a long and messy way of going about your question, but I hope it gives us some pillars along the path for our discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot to unpack there. And I think first, this is a utility that was founded in 1923 and was kind of an instrument of South Africa's apartheid regime for many years. It did not provide electricity to the townships that the country's black population was largely segregated into. And so it's my understanding that with the abolishment of apartheid, Eskom did launch some of those targeted initiatives in an effort to remedy those inequalities. But I'm curious whether amidst their present-day struggles, that legacy still manifests in these racially disparate impacts or outcomes relative to blackouts or cost or things like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I think the first thing to think about is essentially South Africa has the most extensive grid network and the highest generation capacity on the African continent. Now, for most of apartheid's legacy, electrification rates were below 60%. So, I mean, that also has to do with the status of electricity as it relates to people's basic functions. I mean, you know, consumer electronics wasn't quite in the same place in the 60s and 70s as it is today. But as it became more used, especially in residential applications, and also as there was more money to be made, there became a demand that was met partially by Eskom. But also, as we move into the 90s, there was essentially it's one of the early evidences of some creative and important redistributive work. There was an electrification committee that essentially used some of Eskom's financial reserves that it had at the time of the transition to roll out one of the largest electrification schemes on the African continent. And it's important to highlight this because when you think about our neighbors, when you think about what happened to Mozambique at the turn of its independence, there were stories about the Portuguese settlers, you know, ripping cables out of the ground. You know, so it's not by like some sort of magical feature about where people are born or what heritage they hold that maps onto why some places are energy poor. You know, there's political, economic reasons. There's also, you know, some of these subjective factors, like how transitions were navigated. So I think this is one interesting case where an institution was partially transformed. And essentially, you know, some of the resources that did exist were filtered down into building and expanding infrastructure. Now, there were some problems, though. One of the issues, and this dovetails with the late apartheid state's perspective on development, one of the issues is, do you upgrade essentially townships that exist in informal settlements built on the periphery of cities as a byproduct of apartheid spatial planning? Do you upgrade people where they are? Or do you embark on a more ambitious urban and rural land reform process, right? And of course, your electrification scheme within the context of that urban and rural land reform might look a little bit different to what we have today. So while South Africa does reach up to 85% electrification, we do still have the problem that there are enduring phenomena of informal settlements in South Africa, and in fact, a growing number of them, as a compounding, you know, feature of having not dealt with the structure of the apartheid economy and not having done urban land reform, not having done rural land reform, and really thinking about where urban policy and apartheid spatial planning meets energy policy. Because, you know, reticulation of electricity infrastructure is also based on the idea that you have a piece of land that has a title deed that has a particular relationship to the local government. In an informal settlement, it doesn't look like that. And also a dwelling doesn't look like that. A home doesn't look like that. It might be a tin shack. So in certain areas, you might have people who are communities who are tapping off by law illegally, you know, tapping off from transformers or from overhead lines into their homes and accessing electricity in that way. They may be using batteries. They may be using a whole range of systems. But it is very difficult under the typical way in which an electrification scheme is rolled out from that is grid connected to roll out such a program where people don't have decent housing. So I would say it was an interesting example of redistribution, but it also does lift out some of the contradictions in that there were hopes that we would, you know, end the practice of townships, that there would be urban land reform, that there would be rural land reform. The reason why, you know, the relationship between people being dispossessed and then also finding themselves in precarious housing in urban areas is very much tied to the question of energy poverty. Fast forward to today, because of the issues that I listed, you know, the price of electricity has to, even though it is regulated, it has to keep rising because there isn't a commensurate redistributive policy, either via tax or some other similar mechanism, to ensure that the wealthy pay more in service of providing the public good that is affirmed in the Constitution. Because that mechanism doesn't quite exist, and because other needs are not being met, access to water, access to decent housing, as the electricity price rises, there's a growing pool of people who are experiencing energy poverty. You have the 15% of people who were never connected to electricity. And then you also have people who are living in urban areas who form part of the working classes who maybe have a grid connection, but they cannot afford to use electricity to meet their basic needs. And more recently, we see a lot of switching back away from using electric stoves and moving back to fuels, paraffin and gas, you know, for cooking.
Got it. So this also sounds like it's connected to some of what you were talking about in your first question, these issues of spatial and racial inequality and housing inequality that are all tied into this, and an inability or lack of political will to engage in some of the more serious economic redistribution. So I want to return to something that you mentioned in your first answer, which is, of course, these directives from institutions like the World Bank and other international financial institutions that are pushing for some of these hybrid blended models or, you know, a pathway towards privatization. There's also the fact here that a large portion of ESKOM's current debt is already owed to foreign investors. So how do you view what's happening to ESKOM in the context of larger questions around capitalism and development, in particular the role of Western institutions and investors in Africa's development or underdevelopment, and that role in perpetuating some of these inequalities that result in these adverse outcomes for energy consumers?
Yeah. So as a segue to answering your question, there's two pieces I missed. Sorry, one piece I really missed out there on the inflation costs. There were two massive coal plants that were built in South Africa, Medupi and Kusile Power Plant, which do account for a good chunk of the debt that you just mentioned. Now, and you know, those projects are still not fully operating at capacity. There are also coal projects, you know, that has some environmental implications. And then there's a significant amount of debt that was taken on as part of, you know, of completing those mega projects. Now, I think the interesting question, you know, South Africa is, I think, it has the largest carbon emissions footprint on the African continent. Now, I think the African continent cumulatively only accounts for about 5% of historical emissions. However, South Africa is under a lot of pressure to decarbonize its energy system and to move away from coal. I think also coal as a technology internationally is also cited as being one of the key fuels to leave in the past as part of meeting, you know, our international obligations to addressing climate change. That places obviously a lot of pressure on the South African economy at a time where we have high levels of unemployment, we have slowing economic growth, and we have embraced, you know, decades of austerity policies that impact our ability to provide social welfare. And so our ability to respond to shocks into the economy is also weakened. And the, you know, needing to switch, essentially overhaul your energy infrastructure in a climate where money isn't growing on trees, and definitely low interest money for the South isn't growing on trees, will involve shocks. And so the fact that we don't have a social welfare system that can buttress that flow for a segment of the economy that is offering reasonably high wages, you know, mine workers in coal areas, power plant workers on quote-unquote dirty plants are earning reasonably high wages and are experience relatively high levels of unionization. Whereas other emerging sectors of the economy, you know, you have the opposite trends, more precarity and low wage work, you know, in a country that has experience and is recovering from, you know, as I mentioned, austerity policies and also deindustrialization. So it is a tense environment. It is also an environment where, in essence, ESKOM has not been fully privatized. I think that will continue. I think even for those who want to realize that, that's going to be a struggle. One of the key reasons is that electricity price in the global south is a very political issue. In order to pay for the actual cost, for the average citizen to pay for the actual cost of the provision of electricity, it may not be palatable to the citizenry. That's something that will be put to the test. Yeah. Raising prices can be very explosive and can have a lot of knock-on effects on other basic commodities. The other side of it, though, is that in order to access investment for new infrastructure, we've been told, so for renewable energy, we must allow the private sector to invest in renewable energy. So there have been all sorts of straps that have been put on the state-owned utility that prevent it from participating in investing in new generation infrastructure. Very interestingly, the National Treasury provided a debt relief package to ESKOM, I think it was in 2023, either 2023 or 2022, to alleviate some of the debt burdens of the utility. And one of the conditions was that it will agree to not participate in any new investments in generation specifically. It must invest tremendous amounts of funds and execute, support the execution of a massive transmission build out, which will enable private generators to access opportunities in the Northern Cape of South Africa, which has high renewable energy resource potential, particularly wind and solar. So you start seeing we are being hamstrung by the attitudes of the holders of the international purse strings, funders of the attitude, you know, these some of the same players who may have been funding coal in South Africa and benefiting from the extraction of coal and other downstream, you know, other resources that the coal fleet helped lift out of South Africa, gold, platinum, diamonds. In the British Empire, British democracy benefited significantly from that in the 20th century. Now you have British private equity firms, the British government, who are supporting climate compacts that are essentially forcing South Africa to ensure that private generation opportunities are made possible, and private ownership of renewable energy is the way that renewable energy should be explored, and that is your future. So your future system is still one that's under our control, but the dynamics are different. So some of the questions then are around, and some of the tensions, I think, in the left section of the civil society space is, well, how do we develop a green industrial policy that both acknowledges the importance of responding to our international commitment to each other and to other, you know, people in this world who are about to face tremendously negative impacts of climate change, but also respond to the fact that we have certain types of infrastructure. We're not starting from a blank slate. We unfortunately inherit, it wasn't of our own development that these coal plants were built. We've inherited this system, and its performance is very much tied to everyday livelihoods. When the coal plants, unfortunately for the short term, when the coal plants perform poorly, we have load shedding that results in job losses, that has public health implications, and so on and so on. So we need to ensure in the short term that the coal plants are developed well. In the long term, we need to fight the fight about what green industrial policy looks like to ensure that we revive the manufacturing sector in South Africa, to ensure that there's high-quality jobs that are created, to ensure also that the status of electricity as a public good is not eroded. Because what is not often lifted up and what is implied by the policy that ensures that private generators will control South Africa's future is also that those private generators will be guaranteed a particular rate of return that is protected by the sovereign, protected by the National Treasury, protected by the public. And that is embedded within a model, the hybrid model of electricity liberalization and electricity liberalization dispositions, or like that net of policies, which necessarily imply that you have less redistributive policies and that you rely more on collecting rates for revenues for utilities, for private utilities. So I think we are in that difficult space of, you know, of trying to ensure that we do develop a green industrial policy by not giving up the fight for ownership and control of our energy system. It's just unfortunate that one of the best levers that we have at our disposal is also, you know, fossil fuel-based resources. And that therein lies, I think, one of the challenges of our development. And you often see this tension about also unions, particularly unions in the energy sector, saying, well, listen, well, why don't we continue to explore some of the resources that we have, you know? If there's gas deposits found off the coast of South Africa, why don't we explore that and see how we can leverage that to pursue other types of economic opportunities? And so I think it's a difficult and an uncomfortable debate, but I think that it's one that I think is very much alive in that question you're raising about development and its tensions.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to pick up on what you were saying there about unions. Because I think it mirrors a lot of the dynamics that we see here in the United States about the positionality of unions and climate activists and the sort of complicated and somewhat fraught relationship between the two. It's my understanding that the South African labor movement has been pretty active in opposing the privatization of Eskom. Could you talk a little bit about why that is, and then maybe a little bit more about these tensions that come up around both renewable energy and also potentially the idea that energy is a public good. Especially I'm curious about that because unions here actually tend to not be in favor of public power because they tend to have a more favorable arrangement for negotiating contracts with private entities. So I'm also wondering about the difference there.
Yeah. So on the one side, I suppose there is a straightforward self-interest in that the mines are relatively, you know, have strong unions, and the power plants are highly unionized under ESCOM, and there's bargaining power, and there's also some, they have won significant victories over time, you know, over decades. Housing allocations, you know, opportunities for to support children in school, you know, wages, occupational health and safety, affirmative action. There's a significant accumulation of victories there, you know. So I think that that element is relatively straightforward in that it makes sense to support public power because you've seen firsthand what having a state-owned utility has meant for bargaining power, and also what these particular types of plants, because they are highly centralized, there's a certain ease of organizing with other technologies that are more dispersed. There's challenges that are still to be overcome, but that's, you know, that's kind of a new frontier. But at least from a union self-interest perspective, it makes sense in the South African case. Also because we're coming from a system that has public power. So, you know, talking about private power is talking about the unknown. On the other side of the coin, trade unions in South Africa have been at the heart of radical policy development and for a long time. And I think that, and also particularly challenging the creep of neoliberalism after the embrace of democracy in 1994. So some of the first contestations around the creep of neoliberal energy policy were fought by the likes of COSATU in 1998 already. It was an energy white paper in 1998 that already provisioned the possibility for private generators in South Africa, which was largely unexplored commercially for several years after that. But that was part of a net of policy reforms within the government that trade union federations like COSATU were opposing. You know, they were opposing PPPs, private-public partnerships. They're opposing austerity policies and, you know, demanding a different macroeconomic framework, because the concern was this would reduce welfare, this would lead to deindustrialization, and. So it's a long-standing fight. I think today the ground is a little bit more murky. One of the reasons is this. So the COSATU is part of the Tripartite Alliance. The Tripartite Alliance is an alliance between the South African Communist Party, Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, and the ruling African National Congress. Under that framework, COSATU has been able to historically, you know, from their perspective, they've been able to leverage their relationship in the alliance to advocate certain demands. The further down the path, the neoliberal path the ANC has walked, the more tense the relationship is between workers and the African National Congress, and the less persuasive that argument of having influence holds. Nevertheless, you know, there was a massacre in Marikana in 2012, which our president is implicated in, which is a story perhaps for another time. And I encourage our listeners to do a Google search about the Marikana massacre and documentary Miners Shot Down. The aftermath of that event, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, SAFTU, was established. And one of the largest energy sector and mining unions in South Africa formed the backbone of SAFTU, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, NUMSA. And NUMSA had a very radical policy outlook, which also included energy. And they, in the South African context, also coined the term socially owned renewable energy. And already as early as 2012, were thinking about ways to prevent private capture of renewable energy resources, saying that there should be social ownership. And social ownership could be everything from the level of community ownership to also, you know, some expanded version of state ownership. Unions have been at the front end, you know, as the neoliberal policies, every time they have emerged, they've been attempting to knock them down. But it remains a contested space. Not everybody's on the same page about moving away from coal, or moving away from coal at the same rate. Because also in some instances, keep in mind that these are also unions of mine workers and also of workers at coal plants. Not everybody's going to agree on that. people are also concerned that, you know, decommissioning, we decommissioned one plant as part of the energy transition path, and it was the process was a disaster, especially for workers who are not unionized. So a lot of casualized workers, outsourced workers, talking about like catering staff, gardeners, cleaners, you know, they were left in the lurch. They were left to hang out to dry in the process of decommissioning. And that story travels. So this notion, the idea of climate change and the energy transition, for some, is being seen as a Western imposition and is one that is going to essentially hand our energy system over to the private sector. And the media meta-narratives are, well, renewable energy is, it's clean, it's green, it's private, and it's efficient. Public sector is dirty, it's inefficient, it's corrupt, it's nepotistic. And you can almost, even as I'm saying these words, you could even, if you were brave enough with yourself, you could even put colors next to those two phrases. There's a certain way in which we talk about public is dirty. And there's a that can be quite incendiary in a post-apartheid South Africa where you have a majority black government. Like some of the associations there, I think, can be quite incendiary and polarizing. So, you know, unions are, of course, they're enmeshed in all these debates. And I think, you know, for us, I met Trade Unions of Energy Democracy. Sean Sweeney was one of the founders, where they were doing some of this work, advocating for public energy, building with unions in South Africa, and have since been supporting for years, helping them develop their campaigns, and also try and win those positions internally within the unions, which is something that people don't often need to talk about. We got to win these positions within our own bases, within our own constituencies, and to continuously make the case and also be challenged on our case and say, listen, we don't want public ownership simply because we, you know, prefer it because we read a couple of books, but because we have observed, we have lived through, we have studied, and we believe that private ownership and a privatized system is incompatible with the provision of electricity as a public good. And our starting point is one that we think most people believe in, is that energy, electricity access is a public good. And then we have the, when we get to the industrial development question, of course, that is a much more complicated beast. But at least at the level of you know, provision for basic services, it's very clear what the role of public ownership could be. And following from that, it's important for us to ask these questions about who's setting electricity rates, how are different entities within the states being funded, but also how does inequality with electricity relate to other deeper entrenched inequalities in the country? You know, we don't want to set the expectation here that, you know, having a fully public energy system will somehow resolve like the housing issue and the water issue. These things are, of course, integrated. Of course, the reason that we go through PPPs in electricity is also because PPPs were being pushed as a model for utility service provision more generally in the South and including in South Africa. You know, so we definitely see like it's a sectoral approach, but it's embedded within a much bigger question about how we structure our economies and how we're being prevented from asking questions about like what does a redistributive policy look like? What do reforms look like that have the genuine potential to actually help us rebuild our union movement, rebuild our social movements, rebuild our social fabric so that it can actually get to another stage where it can make, you know, stronger, more transformative demands. But to move from a place of rapidly expanding inequality, continuously decreasing standards of living, really harsh living standards, you know, to shift away from that and provide a pathway that gives us more options, more abilities to maneuver, and also more opportunities to adapt as we also face this climate crisis.
You've provided such rich commentary on all these issues. And unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time a little bit. But as we wrap up here, I would like to know, you know, you're starting to get into these bigger questions of addressing some of the larger scale inequalities in South Africa and in the world. What do you think needs to be done in the short, medium, and long term to turn ESCOM into a truly robust and democratized public power institution that can achieve some of these goals that you're talking about? Clean energy, equitable provision of services, you know, a more accessible utility for everyone.
Yeah. So my 2025 hot take is that, okay, so South Africa has, for short background, South Africa's agreed to unbundle its, and it's quite gone far and long in the process to unbundle its electricity sector and separate out into generation, transmission, distribution. It's revising its electricity policy to make the tariff more reflective of the costs, like we discussed earlier. My hot take is that that is not going to work, and it's not going to be, it's going to be rejected by the general public. There's only a certain level of increases that will be tolerated. And so at the moment that that takes place, and I think this speaks to South Africa is in a difficult moment. Politics have in general shifted to the rightwards. But I think that at that moment of policy failure, which is looming, I anticipate a couple of things to happen at the same time. One is that the international commitments for funding are not going to precipitate. So we're not going to get billions and trillions to move away from coal in the next 10, 15 years. Two, it's not going to be politically possible to charge the electricity rates that people want that also match the new massive infrastructure bills like new transmission, big transmission buildouts and so on. And three, that there is going to be a generalized crisis around service provision because of the austerity policies that are being embraced currently. So I think at that moment of fracture, what the left needs to do, what unions need to do, what we are trying to support, is to develop an alternative platform and to build strength within our bases, our constituencies, our political instruments that essentially make the case and make a solid case for what reclaiming public control over strategic sections of the economy towards a new industrial development path and having state-owned enterprises being one of the key strategic levers with all of their faults, but as one of the key strategic levers for realizing that next phase. And I think electricity is one of the key sectors embedded within that. And what that will mean, and I think this is the part that becomes potentially difficult for building the bridge between civil society and unions, it may mean, if it's true that the international commitments don't come through for helping us decarbonize, it may mean a slightly longer reliance on fossil fuels than would be ideal. It would mean, you know, once we, if you take over, if we fully take over a system that is largely fossil fuel dependent, not simply running our fossil fuel assets into the ground because we hate dirty energy, but actually adequately maintaining and rebuilding the integrity of the institutions and supporting a healthy culture within the state-owned company, even where there is dirty energy, and then encouraging it to expand and to develop other resources, you know, to use, to build off its existing skills base and transfer that to other sectors to help build new public housing, to help build new electrification schemes that match the unfulfilled promises of urban and rural land reform, to think about how does a decentralized energy system look in creative ways, you know, massive rollout of solar geyser programs or strategically publicly invested solar parks and wind turbines and certain, embedded within the networks within our country, but actually owned by municipalities and owned, in some cases by land that is held by Eskom itself. But we have to embrace both sides. We have to embrace the aspect of the infrastructure that already exists and also the elements of creativity and of future building that we want to see. Noting that, you know, we are limited with the resources that we have, and we're also constrained by the pressures that, you know, people don't want to pay. So a dance is going to have to be done. We're also going to have to shape the tax policy of the future. We'll have many things to contend with, because we also want, you want to have a social safety net for people who are not working, but unemployment levels may reach 50% if they are not already there. You know, they may reach 50% by the time that crisis hits. And so, you know, we also have to then be talking about how public investment should be driving employment within the economy, so that all the pressure for that tax revenue that we're collecting isn't simply on, you know, grants and other, which is very important. But it's not only on social safety in that sense, but it's also about creating new jobs and creating employment opportunities, and then ensuring that the union movement is at a healthy place where that happens, that they can capture that energy, organize that energy, and feed back into the machine the demands that help transform how the machine is being built in service of the people. So it's a long answer, but I think that the crisis is coming. The only question is about whether we are going to be able to capture that moment and present an alternative path.
Well, the stakes certainly seem high, but they are for all of us. So, Brian, I really appreciate your time today and your very thoughtful analysis. Brian Kamanzi, researcher with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with Brian Kamanzi, researcher with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. Thank you once again to Brian for taking the time to speak with me and to share his deep knowledge of the politics of energy and utilities in South Africa. If you'd like more of his perspective, he actually wrote an excellent article late last year for the online publication Africa is a Country. His piece was entitled Marketplace of Failure, and you can find that at africasacountry.com. Of all the insight that Brian delivered about the situation with Eskom in South Africa, I was most struck by the way that Eskom's viability is so intertwined with the legacy of apartheid, with economic justice and providing people decent housing, and with a paradigm of so-called international development that privileges wealthy Western nations and investors at the expense of the Global South's infrastructure. The mere existence of publicly owned power does not solve these problems, both in the Global South and here in the U.S., where we tend to export those problems all around the world. To do that, you need social movements, you need fighting unions, you need a critical mass of people who are willing to fight for a democratized future for everyone. But we have ample evidence from here in the U.S. that ceding energy to the market certainly hasn't produced the outcomes we need either. And ultimately, publicly owned energy systems create the possibility of democratic planning that is essential for a functional renewable energy transition and essential to produce outcomes on the basis of social good rather than profit. So, no, public power is not itself a panacea. But I think, as our conversation kind of revealed, it's still worth fighting for. That's today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio here in Champaign, Illinois. You can listen to recordings of The Rift on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast aggregator of your choice. The recording of this episode will be up later this evening. Up next on WEFT, we've got some tunes up until the top of the hour, and then, as usual, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be on April 6th, and until then, stay safe out there. We'll see you soon. Thank you.